necessities, Nancy said.
You're becoming more like your mother, Sylvie said,
and Nancy replied,
Thank you. I'll take that as a compliment.
Which riled Sylvie even more. Sylvie, of course, had never quite got over being denied a wedding by Teddy and Nancy. They had sneaked away, in her words.
Not exactly the kind of photographs you can put in a silver frame, are they?
She sighed, when she scrutinized the tiny snaps Bee had taken on the day on her old box brownie.
The cake is delicious,
Nancy said in an effort to mollify Sylvie, but was distracted by a large bee that dropped from exhaustion onto the rug and became entangled in the fibers of wool. Nancy encouraged it onto the palm of her hand and carried it over to the hedge, where she sought out a shady patch for it.
It will die, Sylvie said to Teddy. They never recover. They're worn out by hard work. They're the Methodists of the insect world.
Yet the instinct is to save, Teddy said, regarding Nancy fondly as she tended to the bee, insignificant in the greater order of things.
Perhaps sometimes we shouldn't, Sylvie said. So hot, she added, fanning herself with a napkin. I'm going inside, and the cake is not delicious. Nancy was always a good liar.
They had had no suspicions of winter when they moved into Mouse Cottage. They were still talking of getting a flock of leghorns and learning beekeeping, of digging over the neglected garden and planting potatoes the first year to turn over the soil.
Eden raised, Nancy laughed.
There had even been talk of a goat. None of these things had come to pass by the time the long dark nights closed in on them. They had been too taken up with each other, grasshoppers enjoying the summer, rather than ants preparing for the winter. They were both immensely relieved that they had never got as far as the goat. It was difficult now to remember those first summer evenings, the stored heat of the day beneath the eaves, the worn cotton curtains billowing idly at the wide-open casement. They made love when it was still light, fell into an ecstasy of sleep, and woke to make love again at dawn. They never saw the dark. Now they had an old grey horse blanket tacked up at the window, and lived in terror of draughts. There was ice on the window panes, both inside and out.
It's no better here, Ursula wrote from London.
They picked up their post from a makeshift box at the end of the track. They had left for work by the time the post was delivered, and, never having witnessed the heroics of their postman, could only imagine them. Their own efforts seemed epic enough. They had bought an old Army Land Rover at auction, with some of Izzy's very generous wedding present money. Her standard gift for family weddings was a set of fish knives and forks, but she handed Teddy a large check over afternoon tea at Brown's.
Augustus owes you, she said.
Augustus, who had never grown as Teddy had, who had remained irresponsible and endlessly culpable. Teddy occasionally wondered what Augustus would be doing if he had grown. He imagined that this fictional doppelganger, Gus, would now be hanging around Soho in the grimy aftermath of war, frequenting disreputable pubs and clubs. A more interesting story, surely, than Augustus and the Disappearing Act, the latest offering in the Augustus oeuvre, which had made it through the snow 2 days ago and was sitting unread on top of Nancy's piano, in which Augustus joins a local magic circle and wreaks his usual mischief, it said on the back of the jacket.
Even this eternal winter must end, Nancy said. And we have the snowdrops as proof. You did see them, didn't you? You weren't just making it up for your column.
He was surprised that she would think such a thing.
Of course not, he said.
He was beginning to wish he had never seen the dratted snowdrops, let alone chosen them as his subject. He was looking forward to March, with its abundance of birds and buds. There would be no shortage of topics for Agrestis in the spring. He took a log from the basket and placed it on the fire. It spat out a glittering shower of sparks onto the hearthrug. They both watched with interest to see if any of them would catch, but they sputtered harmlessly and died.
Why don't you go on?
Nancy said. Sure?
Yes.
Her eyes firmly on her knitting. Nancy was always a good liar. Some say the snowdrop was first brought to these lands by the Romans. Others say that they were first cultivated by monks, or perhaps nuns, and indeed in many of Shakespeare's bare-ruined choirs they can be found carpeting the ground in profusion in spring. Yet somehow it feels like a flower that is native, that has been here since the dawn of time, the very essence of Englishness. One legend of the snowdrop's origins tells how when Adam and Eve were expelled from the garden, they were sent into what seemed to them to be the punishment of eternal winter, and that an angel, taking pity on them, turned a snowflake into a snowdrop, as a sign that spring would return to the world. A yawn again from Nancy, perhaps less well concealed.
I am only looking for corrections to mistakes, Teddy said. You don't have to like it.
She looked up from her knitting and said,
I do like it. Don't be such a sensitive soul. I'm just tired, that's all. Those of us enduring this unforgiving winter can perhaps sympathize only too readily with our biblical forebears. Candlemas in the Catholic calendar is the feast of the purification of Mary. It's quite wordy, isn't it? Don't you think?
Wordy? Teddy said. Before the war, he had fancied himself as something of a poet, and had a couple of poems published in obscure literary magazines. But on a visit home to Fox Corner during the war, he had looked through these antebellum offerings, kept in a shoebox beneath his childhood bed, and saw them for what they were, the amateur scribblings of an immature mind. In style, they relied on vague, tortuous metaphors, nearly always in an attempt to describe his response to nature. He was drawn to the grand Wordsworthian sweep of hill and vale and water.
You have a pagan soul, Nancy had once told him, but he didn't agree.
He had the soul of a country parson who had lost his faith. But it didn't matter now, for the great god Pan was indeed dead, and war had long ago killed Teddy's desire to make poetry. After graduating from Oxford, he had applied to stay on and do an MPhil, putting off the time when he would have to find a career. In his heart of hearts, he still wanted to be a train driver, but he supposed that was out of the question. He would have been very surprised, and thrilled, too, if someone had told him that 5 years later he would be training to be a pilot. He had settled on Blake's poetry for his research, for what he thought of as his opaque simplicity. What on earth does that mean? Sylvie said. But when it came to it, he was too restless, and abandoned Blake after a term, and went home to Fox Corner. He was tired of the analysis and dissection of literature, like an autopsy, he said to Hugh, who had invited him into the growlery for a glass of malt and a little chat about his future.
I would like, Teddy said thoughtfully, to travel around a bit, to see the country, and perhaps a little of Europe, too.
By the country, he meant England rather than the whole of Britain, and by Europe, he meant France, but refrained from saying so, as Hugh had a rather baffling prejudice against the French. Teddy tried to explain to his father that he wanted to respond directly to the world.
A life of the senses, as you might say. To work on the land and write poetry. The two are not contradictory.
No, no, not at all, Hugh said. Virgil and the Georgics and so on. A farmer-poet, or a poet-farmer. Hugh had been a banker all his life, which was most certainly not a life of the senses. From the age of 12, Teddy had worked on Ettringham Hall Farm in the holidays, not for the money, he was often unpaid, but for the pleasure of hard labour in the fresh air.
I can't think of anything worse, Izzy said.
She had found him helping out in the milking shed on a visit to Fox Corner, and had almost got herself crushed by a cow.
In my heart, I'm not an intellectual, he said to his father,
knowing this was a stance that would appeal to Hugh, who did indeed nod in sympathy, And to be connected to the land, Teddy said, isn't that the most profound relationship of all? And out of this would come writing that wasn't just the dry product of the intellect. Another nod from Hugh, but was felt, on the pulses. Perhaps even a novel. How callow he had been.
A novel?
Hugh said, unable to stop his eyebrows from rising.
Fiction?
Sylvie was the novel reader, not Hugh. Hugh was a man of his time. He liked facts. But Teddy was one of Hugh's favourite children. Both Hugh and Sylvie had secret listings for their children, not so secret in Sylvie's case. They were similar. Pamela came in the middle, Morris at the bottom. But it was Ursula, low on Sylvie's list, who was closest to Hugh's heart. Sylvie's favourite, of course, was Teddy, her best boy. Teddy wondered who she had preferred before he came along. None of them, he suspected.
"Well, you don't want to get stuck," Hugh said.
Did his father feel stuck? Is that why he offered Teddy £20 and told him to go and live life a little? Teddy refused the money. It was important that he make his own way, wherever that was. But he felt enormously grateful for this show of support from his father. Not surprisingly, his mother did not give her blessing.
"You want to do what?" Sylvie said. You have a degree from Oxford and you want to wander around like a troubadour?
A minstrel, Hugh said. A thing of shreds and patches. He was a great Gilbert and Sullivan fan.
Exactly, Sylvie said. Tramps go from farm to farm looking to be hired for work, not the Beresfords.
He's a Todd, actually, Hugh said, unhelpfully.
You've become a tremendous snob, Sylvie, he added, even more unhelpfully. I'm not thinking of doing it forever, Teddy said. A year, perhaps, and then I'll settle on something.
He was still thinking about Sylvie's word troubadour, and how attracted he was to that very unsettled idea. And so he went. He sowed cabbage seed in Lincolnshire, spent the lambing season in Northumberland, helped bring in the wheat harvest in Lancashire, picked strawberries in Kent. He was fed by farmers' wives at big farmhouse kitchen tables, and slept in barns and sheds and dilapidated cottages as the year turned, and during the warm summer nights in his old canvas tent, somewhat mildewed, that had seen him through Cubs and Kibbo Kift. Its most memorable adventure was yet to take place, when in 1938 the tent accompanied Teddy and Nancy on a camping holiday to the Peak District, during which they finally ceased to be friends and became lovers.
Not both, Teddy puzzled. Well, of course, Nancy said.
And Teddy realized that he had known Nancy too long, and was too familiar with her to suddenly fall in love with her. He loved her, of course, but he wasn't in love, and never had been. Would he ever be, he wondered. But that was in the future. Now he was in a sheep barn on lambing watch, reading Houseman and Clare by the light of a tilly lamp. He had been attempting poems almost entirely about landscape and weather, the shoebox poems, that even he found tedious. There was no poetry to be had in sheep, or even lambs for that matter. The little shivering, gaping things. He had always been repelled by Rossetti's The Lambs of Grasmere. Cows yielded nothing but milk. Not for Teddy, Hopkins's Skies of Couple Colour as a Brinded Cow.
I worship Hopkins, he wrote to Nancy from somewhere south of Hadrian's Wall. If only I could write like him.
He was always cheerful in letters. It seemed like good manners, when in fact he was in despair at his own cloddish verse. Izzy came to visit him briefly, staying in a hotel on Lake Windermere, where she stood him an expensive dinner, and plied him with alcohol and questions to lend some authenticity to Augustus Becomes a Farmer. The year turned quickly. The early apple harvest in Kent gave birth to an ode to autumn that would have shamed Keats.
The apples rosy and fair, not yet touched by the fingers of frost.
He was not yet ready to renounce either poetry or husbandry, and boarded a ferry at Dover, a new, unsullied, thick notebook in his bag. Disembarking on the foreign soil of France, he headed due south for the vineyards and the grape harvest, thinking of Keats's beaker of blushful hippocrene, although the hippocrene was in Greece, not France, wasn't it? He hadn't considered Greece. He rebuked himself for the large omission from his itinerary of the cradle of civilization. He rebuked himself again later for having missed the wonders of Venice, Florence, and Rome. But at the time, he had been happy to sidestep the rest of Europe. In 1936, it was a troubled land, and Teddy felt no need to experience its political upheavals. In later years, he wondered if he had been wrong, if he shouldn't have faced up to the evil that was brewing. "Sometimes it takes just one good man," Ursula said to him during the war. Neither of them could think of an example from history. "Except the Buddha, perhaps," Ursula offered. "I'm not convinced by the reality of Christ." "There were plenty of instances where it had taken just one bad man," Teddy said gloomily. "Perhaps there would be time for Greece. After all, his deadline, a year perhaps, was self-imposed." By the time a late Sauterne harvest had finished, he was as brown and strong as a peasant, he reported in a letter to Nancy. His French, too, had gained the coarse fluency of the peasant. After a day's picking, he was ravenous and gorged on the huge evening meals that the domain provided for their workers. At night, he pitched the old canvas tent in a field. For the first time since his childhood at Fox Corner, he slept the dreamless sleep of the dead or the innocent, helped by the copious amounts of wine that accompanied meals. Sometimes there was a woman. He never wrote a word. For the rest of his life, he would be able to close his eyes and conjure up the sight and smell of the food he had eaten in France. He had relished the oily garlickiness of the stews, the artichoke leaves dipped in butter, the earth en cocotte, eggs baked in the oven inside huge beef tomatoes. A saddle of roasted lamb quilted with cloves of garlic and sprigs of rosemary, a work of art. These were tastes that were foreign, in every way, to the bland English palate. Cheese, sour and strong. The desserts, flonade with peaches, clafoutis with cherries, tarte aux noix and tarte aux pommes, and a Fabre Breton, a kind of prune custard tart that to the end of his life he dreamed about eating again, and never did.
"Prunes and custard?" Mrs. Glover said doubtfully when he returned.
Mrs. Glover left Fox Corner soon after Teddy's return, driven away perhaps by his requests for French regional cooking.
"Don't be silly," Sylvie said. "She's retired to live with her sister."
Then there was breakfast, of course, taken at the big table in the domain kitchen, not the gruel-like porridge ladled out at boarding school or the unsurprising egg and bacon of Fox Corner. Instead, he sliced open half a freshly baked baguette, wadded the inside with camembert, and dipped it into a bowl of scalding strong coffee. He forgot all about this way of greeting the day when he returned home, and then, decades later, when he was living in sheltered accommodation at Fanning Court, it came back to him suddenly, and, inspired by the richness of the memory, he bought a baguette from Tesco's, baked on the premises, yes, but from what, and a small round of unripe camembert, and poured his morning coffee into a cereal bowl rather than the usual mug. It was not the same. Not at all. As winter approached, he moved on south. "I'm like the swallow," he wrote to Ursula, until he was stopped by the sea, and rented a room above a cafe in a little fishing village, unspoilt, as yet, by visitors. Every day he sat at a table in the one and only cafe, a jacket and a scarf, all he needed to defend himself against the Riviera winter, and smoked gitan and drank espresso from thick little white cups, his notebook on the table in front of him. By lunchtime he had moved on to wine, with bread and fish straight from the sea and grilled over wood. And by the time the sleepy afternoons had taken hold, he was ready for an aperitif. He was living a life of the senses, he told himself. But deep down he suspected he was shirking his life, and felt accordingly guilty. He was English, after all.
L'écrivain anglais,
the villagers called him, rather fondly, as he was the first poet to visit them, although artists were ten a penny in that part of the world. They were impressed by his colloquial French and his dedication to his notebook. He was glad that they couldn't read his paltry offerings. They might have lost some of their admiration for him. He decided to be more methodical in his approach to art, Sylvie's capital letter. Poems were constructs, not simply words that flowed willy-nilly from the brain. Observations, he had written as a heading at the beginning of the notebook, and the pages were filled with pedestrian images. The sea is particularly blue today, sapphire, azure, ultramarine, and the sun glints off the sea like a thousand diamonds, or the coastline seems composed of solid blocks of colour and hot slices of sunshine. He was rather pleased with that. And Madame la Propriétaire is wearing her funny little green jacket today. Was there a poem to be had from Madame la Propriétaire, he wondered. He thought of the fields of lavender and sunflowers he had seen on his sojourn, all harvested now, and sought out images. The imperial spikes and golden discs of Helios turning to worship their god. If only he was an artist. Paint seemed less demanding than words. He felt sure that Van Gogh's sunflowers hadn't given him as much trouble. Gulls wheeling and screeching overhead, excited by the fishing boats returning home, he wrote carefully, before lighting up another gitane. The sun was below the yardarm, almost, as his father would have said if he were here. How could he not like France? And it was time for a pastis. He began to think of himself as a loafer, a lotus eater. He had enough money saved to winter on the Côte d'Azur, and then perhaps head north and see Paris. One can't die without seeing Paris, Izzy said, although he did. Shortly before Christmas, a telegram arrived. His mother was in hospital. Pneumonia, rather poorly. Best come home, his father had written sparely. Her mother's lungs, Hugh said on Teddy's return. Teddy had never known this grandmother and the legendary lungs that, according to Sylvie, had killed her. Sylvie recovered surprisingly quickly and was home before the year was out. She had not been so very ill. Teddy wasn't sure it had merited a telegram, and for a while suspected some kind of family conspiracy. But she kept asking for you, Hugh said, rather apologetically. The prodigal son, his father said fondly, when he picked him up from the station. To tell the truth, Teddy was rather relieved to give up the pretense of poetry, and after the familiarity of Christmas at Fox Corner, it seemed faintly absurd to journey all the way back to France. And for what? To be a loafer? So instead, when his father found him a position in his bank, he took it. The first day, as he entered the hushed halls of polished mahogany panelling, he felt like a prisoner embarking on a life sentence, a bird with its wings clipped, earthbound forever. Was this it? His life over?
There, Ted, Hugh said. I knew you'd settle to something eventually.
The war, when it came, was an immense relief for Teddy.
Penny for them, Nancy said, taking a tape measure from her knitting basket and placing it against his shoulder.
Not worth it, he said,
back to the wretched snowdrop.
The drop in snowdrop does not, as many think, refer to a snowflake, but to an earring, and one can picture this delicate flower trembling in the ear of some Elizabethan beauty. Strictly speaking, can an earring tremble in an ear? Nancy said, laying down her needles in her lap and frowning at her knitting.
She pulled on her own delicate earlobe to demonstrate the fixity of the small grey pearl therein.
If it were dangling, it could tremble.
She was forensic. She would make a fine high court judge. She could deliver an opinion that bore no weight of emotion and in the most pleasant fashion.
"How cruel you are to me," she said, laughing.
She had hinted before at what she considered the rather flat quality of these pieces. It was journalism, Teddy thought defensively, an inert form of writing. Nancy always wanted everyone to find the best in everything. When they moved to Yorkshire, Teddy found himself in an indifferent boys' grammar school in a smallish woolen mill town, soot-soiled and shoddy, that was quietly dying, and knew from the very first lesson, Romeo and Juliet, women being the weaker vessels are ever thrust to the wall, to a class of sniggering 13-year-olds, that it had been a mistake. He saw the future unravelling before him, day after dismal day. Saw himself dutifully earning money to support Nancy and their as-yet-unborn children, who were already weighting him down with responsibility. Saw himself, too, on the day he finally retired, a disappointed man. It was the bank, all over again. He was a stoic, it had been beaten into him at school, and he was as loyal as a dog, and he knew he would stick it out, no matter how great the sacrifice of self.
"You fought the war for those boys," Ursula said when she visited, "for their freedom. Are they worth it?"
"No, not at all," Teddy said. And they both laughed because it was a cliché that they were already tired of hearing, and they knew that freedom, like love, was an absolute and not to be parcelled out on a whim or a favour. Nancy, on the other hand, loved her profession. She was a maths teacher in a grammar school for well-behaved, clever girls in a pleasant spa town. She enjoyed making them even cleverer, even better behaved, and they loved her in return. She had lied on application, told the school that she was unmarried, not even a widow, erasing Teddy efficiently from her history. She was Miss Shawcross again.
"They don't like married teachers," she explained to Teddy. "They leave to have babies, or they are distracted by their domestic life, by their husbands."
Distracted? Of course, the plan was to give up teaching when they started a family, but that was in the lap of the gods, and the gods didn't appear to be in a hurry. She knew how miserable Teddy was teaching. One of the many good things about Nancy was that she didn't believe that people should suffer unnecessarily. It always surprised Teddy how many people did. She encouraged him to take up writing again.
"A novel this time," she said.
She had read the shoebox poems, and Teddy supposed her opinion of them was pretty much the same as his.
"A novel," she said. "A novel for the new world. Something fresh and different that tells us who we are and what we should be."
The world didn't seem very new to Teddy, but rather old and weary, as he suspected himself to be. And he wasn't sure he had anything to say that was worth writing about. But Nancy seemed determined that he would have talent.
"At least have a go," she said. "You won't know if you can do it until you try."
And so he allowed Nancy to cajole him into sitting down in the evenings and at the weekends in front of the little Remington that she had found in a second-hand shop. No more observations, he thought. No more thick notebooks. Just get on with it. He found a title, first, calling his debut upon the literary stage A Bower Quiet for Us, taken from Keats's Endymion. "A thing of beauty is a joy for ever. Its loveliness increases. It will never pass into nothingness, but still will keep a bower quiet for us, and a sleep full of sweet dreams and health and quiet breathing."
Oh, how he must have longed for health and quiet breathing, Ursula said. And perhaps by imagining it, he hoped it would come true.
His sister always spoke sadly of Keats, as if he had only just died. It was an awkward title, though, not exactly catchy.
"It will do," Nancy said, "for now, at any rate."
He knew her thinking. She believed he needed to be healed, and writing might be the physic that did the trick.
"Art as therapy," he had overheard her say to Mrs. Shawcross.
His own mother would have derided such a notion. The opening line of Endymion, "A thing of beauty is a joy forever," was more Sylvie's creed. Perhaps that would have made a better title, "A thing of beauty." Unfortunately, Teddy discovered that every character introduced or plot wrestled with was bland or commonplace. The great authors of the past had set standards that made his own attempts at artifice look puny. He could find no engagement with the one-dimensional lives he had created. If an author was a god, then he was a very poor second-rate one, scrabbling around on the foothills of Olympus. You had to care, he supposed, and there was nothing he cared to write about.
But what about the war? Nancy said.
The war, he thought, secretly amazed that she could think that something so shattering in its reality could be rendered so quickly into fiction.
Life, then, she said. Your life. A Bildungsroman.
I think I would rather just live my life, Teddy said, not make an artifice of it.
And what on earth would he write about? If you excluded the war, an enormous exclusion, he acknowledged, then nothing had happened to him. A boyhood at Fox Corner, the brief, rather lonely and pointless life of a wandering poet-come-farmhand, and now the quotidian of married life, the log on the fire, the choice between Ovaltine or cocoa, and Nancy's neat, contained self, bundled up in sweaters against the cold. He was not complaining about the latter. He knew he should feel lucky to have it, when so many he had known did not.
"Oh, teach me how I should forget to think,"
a boy whose name he would never remember read out in lifeless tones, and the bell rang, causing the whole class to rise up like a flock of sparrows and jostle their way out of the classroom door before he had dismissed them.
"Discipline doesn't seem to be your forte," the disappointed headmaster said. "I thought, being an RAF officer..."
Teddy sat at his desk in the empty classroom, waiting for a second-year English class to make its appearance. He looked around the dingy room with its scents of india rubber and unwashed necks. The morning sun was shining softly through the windows, the dust of chalk and of boys caught in a beam of sunlight. There was a world outside these walls. He stood up, abruptly, and marched out of the classroom, squeezing his way past a gaggle of 11-year-olds coming reluctantly through the door.
"Sir,"
one of them said, alarmed by this dereliction of duty. He was AWOL, driving home on the high back road, thinking he might stop somewhere and go for a long hike to give himself time to think. He was in danger of becoming a drifter, a man who couldn't stick to anything. His brothers were doing well for themselves. Jimmy was in America, leading a fast, glossy life, earning big bucks, while Morris was a Whitehall mandarin, a pillar of respectability. And here he was, unable even to be a lowly teacher. He had made a vow during the war that if he survived, he would lead a steady, uncomplaining life. The vow seemed doomed to be unfulfilled. Was there something wrong with him, he wondered. He was saved by a motorist who had broken down by the side of the road. Teddy stopped the Land Rover and went to see if he could help. The old Humber Pullman had its bonnet propped up, and the man was staring at the engine in the helpless way of the unmechanical, as if through the power of his thoughts alone he might get it working again.
"Ah, a gentleman of the road,"
the man said, doffing his hat, when Teddy drew up in the Land Rover.
"This darn thing's worn out. Like me. Bill Morrison," he said, extending a meaty hand.
While Teddy fiddled with the alternator, they chatted about the hawthorn trees, in full glorious flush, that lined this particular stretch of road.
"The May," Bill Morrison called it.
It lifted his heart to see it, he said. Afterwards, Teddy couldn't clearly recall this conversation, but it had roamed all over the shop, as Bill put it. From the place of the hawthorn in English folklore, the Glastonbury thorn, and so on, to the Queen of the May and the Maypole, and Teddy had told him how for the Celts the tree marked the entrance to the other world, and that the ancient Greeks had carried it in wedding processions.
University man, I take it,
Bill Morrison said, admiring rather than sardonic, although perhaps just a smidgen of the latter.
Ever tried your hand at writing?
Well,
Teddy demurred.
How about lunch then, lad? My treat,
Bill Morrison said, as the old Humber coughed back into life. And so Teddy found himself in a convoy of two, on the way to a hotel in Skipton, for what turned out to be a rather boozy roast beef affair, during the course of which he had his life examined from every angle by Bill Morrison. He was a large bluff man with a high, unhealthy colour, who had cut his teeth on the Yorkshire Post a long time ago, and was now a blunt, old-fashioned Tory.
Avuncular, but sharp, Teddy reported to Nancy later.
His god was a robust Anglican, a Yorkshireman, who probably played cricket for the county when he wasn't sending laws down from the mountain. As time went by, Teddy learned more of Bill's generous heart and gruff kindness. He liked the fact that Teddy was married,
a natural state for a man,
and teased his war out of him. Bill himself had
survived the Somme.
He was the editor of the Recorder. It was a surprisingly long time afterwards that Teddy learned that he also owned the Recorder.
You know it, Ted?
Yes,
Teddy said politely. Did he? A vague recollection in the dentist's waiting room, distracting himself from the imminent removal of a rotten tooth, dental care not having been a priority in the POW camp.
Because I'm looking for someone to write the nature notes,
Bill Morrison said.
It's just a few lines every week. It won't keep you in bread, let alone bacon, even if you could get your hands on any. We used to have a man did the nature notes, went by the byline Agrestis. That's Latin. Know what it means?
A rustic. A countryman.
Well, there you are.
What happened to the old one?
Teddy asked, while digesting this unexpected offer.
Old age took him off. He was an old-style countryman. He was a difficult bugger, he said affectionately.
Rather shyly, Teddy mentioned his own agricultural curriculum vitae, the Northumberland lambs, the Kentish apples, his love of hill and vale and water, the pleasure to be had from the cup and saucer of an acorn, the unfurling frond of a fern, the pattern on the feather of a hawk, the transcendent beauty of the dawn chorus in an English bluebell wood. He omitted France, the solid blocks of colour, the hot slices of sunshine. They would not be to the taste of a man who had fought on the Somme. Teddy was judged sound, even though he was a southerner.
There were two men,
Bill Morrison said, as they dug into the Stilton. It took Teddy a moment to realise that this was the rather ponderous introduction to some sort of witticism.
One of them was from Yorkshire, God's own country. The other one wasn't a Yorkshireman. The one not from Yorkshire said to the other...
Teddy began to lose track at this point.
I met a Yorkshireman t'other day, and the one from Yorkshire said, how'd they know he were from Yorkshire? And the one not from Yorkshire,
now Teddy began to lose the will to live,
said, because of his accent. And the Yorkshireman said, nah, lad, if he'd been from Yorkshire, it would have been the first thing he told you.
Try putting that in a Christmas cracker, Nancy said, when Teddy attempted to relate it to her that evening after rolling home, somewhat foxed.
Oh, my, you reek of beer. I quite like it. And you have a new job, on a newspaper.
No, not a newspaper, Teddy said.
Not a job either, really, he added. Just a few shillings a week. What about the school? You'll still teach?
The school, Teddy thought. This morning was already the past.
Oh, teach me how I should forget to think.
He had absconded, he said.
Oh, you poor darling,
Nancy laughed.
And this will lead to more, I know it will. I can feel it in my waters.
It did. October with its autumn colours, mushrooms and chestnuts, and the late Indian summer. November brought Mother Nature tucking in her charges for the oncoming struggle, and December was of necessity holly and robins.
Find something heartwarming, Bill said. And so he wrote about how the robin got his red breast. They were pedestrian pieces, but that was fine by Bill Morrison, who wasn't looking for erudition. Another boozy lunch just before Christmas, and he was offered the job of roving reporter. The previous incumbent of the post had died during the war.
Arctic convoys, Bill Morrison said briskly, not wanting to dwell.
And he too will be dead soon, he said, if he get racing around doing the job of two men.
Are you happy now? Nancy asked, as they hung up the holly and mistletoe they had picked in the woods.
Yes, Teddy said, giving the answer perhaps more consideration than the question had demanded.
The blasted snowdrops.
There are some who consider it bad luck to pick these brave little heralds of spring, and will not let them in the house. Perhaps this is due to their profusion in churchyards. Sylvie always picked the first snowdrops at Fox Corner. It was a shame because they wilted and died so quickly. The white of the snowdrop and its association with untaintedness has always given this humble flower an aura of innocence. Who remembers now the snowdrop band of young girls of the previous century? There is a German legend.
Oh, Lord,
Nancy muttered under her breath.
What?
I dropped a stitch. Go on.
Which relates that when God created all things, he told the snow to go and ask the flowers for some colour. All but the kindly snowdrop refused, and in reward the snow allowed it to be the first flower of spring. Great music has the power to heal. Germany is no longer our enemy, and it is salutary for us to remember her rich store of myth and legend and fairy tale, not to mention her cultural heritage, the music of Mozart.
Mozart was Austrian.
Yes, of course, Teddy said. I don't know why I forgot that. Beethoven, then. Brahms, Bach, Schubert. Schubert was German, wasn't he?
No, another Austrian.
Haydn? He hazarded.
Austrian.
There's a lot of them, aren't there?
So,
her cultural heritage of Bach, Brahms, Beethoven.
Nancy nodded silently, like a schoolteacher approving a pupil's corrections. She could just have been counting stitches, of course.
Of these, Beethoven is...
We have rather left the snowdrop behind. Why all this talk of Germans?
Because it was a German legend I was referring to, Teddy said.
This seems to be about forgiving the Germans, though.
Have you forgiven them?
Had he?
Theoretically, perhaps, but not in his heart, where truth resided. He thought of all the men he knew who had been killed. The dead, like demons and angels, were legion. It was 3 years since his own war had ended. He had spent the last years hors de combat in a POW camp near the Polish border. He had parachuted out of a burning aircraft over Germany and had been unable to evade capture because of a broken ankle. His aircraft had been coned and shot down by flak on the dreadful raid to Nuremberg. He hadn't known it at the time, but it was the worst night of the war for Bomber Command. 96 aircraft lost, 545 men killed, more than in the whole Battle of Britain. But by the time he made it home, this was all old, cold news, Nuremberg all but forgotten.
You were very brave,
Nancy said, with the same encouraging indifference, to Teddy's ears anyway, that she might have afforded him if he had done well in a maths test. The war now for him was a jumble of random images that haunted his sleeping self. The Alps in moonlight, a propeller blade flying through the air, a face, pale in the water.
Well, good luck to you then.
Sometimes the overwhelming stench of lilacs, at other times a sweetly held dance tune, and always at the end of the nightmare there was the inescapable end itself, the fire and the sickening hurtle of the fall to earth. In nightmares, we wake ourselves before the awful end, before the fall. But Teddy had to be woken by Nancy's shushing, by her cradle hand soothing him. and he would stare into the darkness for a long time, wondering what would happen to him if she failed to wake him one night. He had been reconciled to death during the war, and then suddenly the war was over, and there was a next day, and a next day, and a next day. Part of him never adjusted to having a future.
Beethoven, he began again doggedly.
You could hardly hold Beethoven responsible for the war. He had a sudden memory, himself and Ursula in the Royal Albert Hall. When was that? 1943? Listening to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the choral, Ursula almost vibrating with the emotional power of the music. He had felt it too, the power of something beyond, something outwith the petty everyday pace. He shook himself, a wet dog.
Are you all right, darling?
An affirmative. Just dislodging the war, the awfulness of it all, the overwhelming sadness. Nothing he could convey in words to her.
And you know, Nancy continued, a blithe spirit, I don't think people necessarily want to be reminded about the war when they're reading Agrestis's Nature Notes. In fact, quite the opposite, I imagine.
Shall I make cocoa? He offered, to escape the subject.
Or would you rather have Ovaltine? Ovaltine, please.
You'll ruin your eyes, he said, as he poured the half-frozen milk into a pan and placed it on the trivet over the fire.
I'm stopping now, she said, efficiently winding up her different coloured balls of wool.
The milk rose up suddenly in the pan, and Teddy snatched it away from the fire before it could boil over. His face, hot from the flames, made him aware of the burn tissue on his neck. It was just visible above his collar, the skin shiny and puckered pink, a promise of other scars in less visible places.
Well, Wing Commander Todd, Nancy said, time for bed, I think.
She never used his wartime rank without a kind of mild irony, as if he had pretended to something. He had no idea why she did that, but it made him shrink inside a little. They retired to Ultima Thule, as they called it, the icebox that was their attic bedroom. Teddy shivered as he stripped himself of his layers and jumped into bed as if he was plunging into the icy waters of the North Sea. They soon warmed each other up after the initial shock of polar sheets and frosty air. Lovemaking was vigorous rather than romantic in this kind of weather.
One is never cold with a husband,
Nancy's sister Millie wrote from the arid heat of Arizona, especially a handsome one like yours. A blizzard had started up, and it sounded as if someone was pelting the windows with snowballs. They were a new Adam and Eve, exiled into eternal winter. Nancy kissed him on the cheek and said,
"Good night, dear heart."
But Teddy was already asleep. Nancy blew out the candle by the side of the bed and waited for Teddy's nightmares to begin. They must have a baby, she thought. They must have a child to heal Teddy, to heal the world. 1939. Teddy's War. Innocence. He didn't hear Chamberlain make his somber declaration on the wireless, because he had chosen instead to take the Shawcross's old dog, Harry, for a walk in the lane. An amble, slow and arthritic, all that the golden retriever was capable of nowadays. His eyes were clouded with cataracts, and a once large frame was now gaunt, the flesh shrunk against the bones. Deaf, too, like Major Shawcross himself. The two of them, man and dog, had snoozed companionably through the long summer afternoons of 1939, locked together in their silent world. Major Shawcross in his old wickerwork chair, and Harry melted on the lawn at his feet.
"It breaks my heart to see him like that," Nancy said.
She meant Harry, although the sentiment extended to her father. Teddy understood the particular poignancy of seeing a dog you had known as a puppy approaching the end of its life.
"Intimations of mortality, as Wordsworth didn't write," Ursula said. "Oh, if only dogs live longer lives. We've mourned so many.
The Shawcross girls were all enormously fond of their old pa, an affection that was more than reciprocated by Major Shawcross. Hugh was close to Pamela and Ursula, of course, but Teddy was always rather surprised at the way that Major Shawcross was so free with his feelings, kissing and cuddling "my girls," and often reduced to tears merely by the sight of them.
"The Great War," Mrs. Shawcross said, "it changed him."
Hugh tended to reticence, a temperament that, if anything, the war had reinforced. Had Major Shawcross wished for a son? Surely he must have done, didn't all men? Did Teddy? He intended to propose to Nancy. Today, perhaps. A day of high historical drama, so that in the future Nancy would say to their children, for they would surely have them, "You know your father proposed to me on the day that war broke out." Teddy felt as if he had been waiting for a long time, too long perhaps. First, so that Nancy at Newnham could complete her maths tripos, and now for her to study for her PhD. Her doctoral topic was something to do with natural numbers. They didn't seem at all natural to Teddy. He didn't want to find himself waiting for the war to be over as well, for who knew how long that would be. Teddy was 25, almost too long in the tooth for marriage, as far as his mother was concerned. She was keen for grandchildren, keener than she had been for the one she already had, courtesy of Pamela, who had 3 boys and counting, and Morris, who had 1 of each. "Like fish and chips," Ursula said. Teddy barely knew Morris's offspring, and Sylvie reported them to be rather dull. Marrying Nancy seemed inevitable. Why wouldn't he marry her?
"Childhood sweethearts," Mrs. Shawcross said,
affected by the idea of romance. His own mother was less affected. Everyone presumed it, even Sylvie, who thought Nancy too clever for marriage.
"Marriage blunts one so." And who else could there possibly be, apart from Nancy, anyway?
Teddy puzzled to Ursula.
"She's by far and away the best person I know. The nicest one, too. And you do love her. And you know that we all do."
"Of course I love her," Teddy said. Had it been a question? Did he know what love was? The love for a father, a sister, for a dog even, yes. But between a husband and wife, two lives knitted inextricably together, or yoked and harnessed.
"That's the point," Sylvie said. "Otherwise we would all run wild."
He thought of Adam and Eve. He thought of Sylvie and Hugh themselves. Neither seemed like terribly good examples.
"Nancy's parents' marriage," Ursula said. "Isn't that a good pattern? Major and Mrs. Shawcross are happy, to all appearances anyway."
But appearance and reality were different things, weren't they? And who knew the secrets of a marriage? He had loved Nancy when they were young, but that was a different kind of thing, high and clear, but childishly innocent. "For now we see through a glass darkly."
"Perhaps more to the point," Ursula said, "how would you feel if you didn't marry her?"
So yes, he thought, of course he would marry Nancy. They would move to a pleasant suburb, have those inevitable children, and he would work his way up in the bank, until one day the staff would perhaps be as deferential to him as they were to his father. Or perhaps not. It wouldn't just be the sharp knife of his wife who would be blunted. The future was a cage closing around him. Wasn't life itself a great trap, its jaws waiting to snap? He should never have returned from France. He should have ceased being indolent, stopped pretending he had a poet's soul, embraced the adventurer in himself instead, and pushed on eastwards, explored the extremities of empire, Australia perhaps, somewhere raw and unsettled, where a man could make himself rather than being made by those around him. Too late for that. Now it would not be the geography of empire that would make him, it would be the architecture of war. They had reached the dairy herds field by now, and Teddy pulled some stalks of long grass from the hedgerow and cried,
"Cush cow! Cush cow!"
But the cows, after the briefest of glances in his direction, remained placidly indifferent. He lit a cigarette and leaned on the gate while he smoked it. Harry had collapsed awkwardly on the ground, his scrawny sides heaving with exertion.
"Poor old boy,"
Teddy said, reaching down and scratching behind the old dog's soft ear. He thought about Hugh. Their paths never crossed at the bank, but his father would occasionally invite Teddy to lunch at his club on Pall Mall. The stolid world of finance suited Hugh, but for Teddy it was stultifying tedium and, occasionally, downright misery. His father would retire soon, of course, potter around the garden, doze over the open pages of his wisdom in the garden or the growlery, get on Sylvie's nerves. That was indeed how Hugh was found, just over a year later, in a garden deck chair, a copy of Wisdom open on his lap, asleep forever. Even this, the least troublesome of deaths, seemed to exasperate Sylvie.
"He just slipped away without a word," she complained,
as if he had owed her more. Perhaps he had.
"Dad was never one to make a fuss,"
Ursula wrote to Teddy in Canada, on flimsy blue, the ink smudged irrevocably where a tear must have dropped. Teddy ground out the cigarette stub beneath his foot and said,
"Come on then, Harry. We're going to miss lunch if we don't get a move on."
The dog couldn't hear him, but he didn't shift even when Teddy gave him a gentle prod, and he feared that he had worn him out completely. He might be a bag of bones, but he was still heavy, and Teddy wasn't sure that he could carry the dead weight of the dog all the way home, although he supposed he would have to manage if there was no alternative. Needs must. But luckily Harry hauled himself heroically onto four legs, and they wended their way slowly back to Nancy's house.
"Oh, stay away, do,"
Mrs. Shawcross implored when she caught sight of him at the back door of Jackdaw's. She flapped a tea towel at him, as if he were a fly. Nancy, at home for the long vacation, was in bed, with what had turned out to be whooping cough.
"At my age,"
being nursed assiduously by Mrs. Shawcross, who knew that Teddy had also missed out on the illness as a child.
"You mustn't catch it," she said. "It's quite horrible in an adult."
"Don't go near that girl,"
Sylvie warned when he told her that he had offered, in the current absence of a resident dog at Fox Corner, to take Harry for a walk. Too late, he thought. That girl was the girl he was going to propose to, but not today after all, perhaps.
"She's really rather poorly,"
Mrs. Shawcross said,
"but I'll give her your love, of course."
"Please do."
The various smells of Sunday lunch wafted out of Mrs. Shawcross's kitchen. Mrs. Shawcross, hair straggling from an untidy bun, looked rather flushed and not a little flustered. But in Teddy's experience, that was the effect that cooking Sunday lunch had on women. Jackdaw's, like Fox Corner, had recently lost its cook, and Mrs. Shawcross seemed even less suited to the culinary arts than Sylvie. Of Major Shawcross, there was no sign. Mrs. Shawcross herself was a vegetarian, and Teddy wondered what she would eat while Major Shawcross was enjoying his beef. An egg, perhaps?
"Oh, Lord, no," Mrs. Shawcross said. "The whole idea of eating an egg makes me feel quite squeamish."
Teddy spotted an open bottle of Madeira on the kitchen table, and a little glass, half full of the brown liquor.
"War,"
Mrs. Shawcross said, her eyes filling with tears, and, infection forgotten, she pulled Teddy towards her in a warm, rather damp embrace. She smelt of the Madeira and of cold tar soap, an unlikely, rather unsettling combination. Mrs. Shawcross was large and soft, and always a little sad. Sylvie was annoyed by the misbehaviour of the world, but Mrs. Shawcross carried the burden of it patiently, as you would for a child. He supposed the war would make that burden heavier. Mrs. Shawcross placed a hand against her temple and said,
"Oh, dear, I think I have one of my heads coming on."
She sighed and added,
"Thank goodness we have girls.
Neville would never be able to face sending a son into battle.
It seemed more than probable to Teddy that he was already incubating the whooping cough. Mrs. Shawcross didn't know that Nancy had travelled up to London last week to see him, sneaking into his lodgings beneath the gimlet eye of his landlady and staying the night. The two